Paul, just so you know, the chair yesterday was very generous. Everybody had an hour.
Yes, I was.
Okay.
The chair this morning said that he didn't like what he did yesterday. And, therefore, I should try and impose more stringent regulations. I don't know.
All right.
You're stronger than I am.
Okay, good morning. So I will talk about the subject of adiabaticity in open quantum systems, and I'll try to leave enough time for two applications, certainly one, geometric phases and adiabatic quantum computing. And this is work that was done with my former postdoc, Marcelo Sarandi, who is now taking up a faculty position in Brazil, his home country. And the work is described in these three publications. So, the adiabatic approximation. What is the adiabatic theorem? What's the adiabatic approximation? Roughly, this is a rough statement, and I will make things more precise as we go on. Roughly, the adiabatic theorem states the following. If you have a Hamiltonian that's time-dependent, and it changes slowly, and slowly is something that has to be defined carefully, and I will, then there will be no transitions. No transitions between different eigenspaces. In other words, our system, described by this evolving under this Hamiltonian, will remain in its instantaneous eigenstate. So let psi n be some energy eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. You can diagonalize the Schrodinger equation at any moment in time. There's a corresponding energy E, and this is the instantaneous eigenstate. So the statement of the adiabatic theorem is that if the dynamics is sufficiently slow, if the Hamiltonian is sufficiently slow, then the system is well described by the state that is the instantaneous solution of the Schrodinger equation at any given time. Now, in fact, this doesn't have to be just one single eigenstate. It can be a whole degenerate eigenspace. So there can be many degenerate sides here that all have the same energy, En. Another way of thinking about it is to say that the energies, they evolve continuously and they do not cross as the dynamic progresses. Okay, so that's the adiabatic theorem, roughly. And why is this important? Well, the adiabatic theorem has had numerous applications, starting probably with the Born-Oppenheimer approximation in chemical physics, which leads to the notion of molecular energy level surfaces. And that has been extremely important in understanding the dynamics of molecules. But at that level, it is just an approximation, and not an exact description of anything, and one might wonder whether it's worth spending a lot of time just discussing approximations. Well, there are situations in which adiabatic dynamics itself is the primary object of interest, because once a system evolves adiabatically, once it's in that limit, all sorts of very interesting phenomena arise, and a prime example thereof is the Berry phase, the geometric phase. And more recently, in the context of quantum computing, there are proposals for quantum computing that specifically make use of adiabatic dynamics, such as adiabatic quantum computing, which I'll say a few words about later, and holonomic quantum computing, which is a way of doing quantum computing with non-abelian geometric phases. So the adiabatic theorem and the adiabatic approximation, adiabatic dynamics, is a subject that is itself very important, has lots of applications, and surprisingly, it has existed ever since 1928 when it was first introduced as a theory that applies only to closed quantum systems. So closed quantum systems are systems that are described by the Schrodinger equation. And since this is a workshop on decoherence, it seems appropriate to consider what happens if we wish to generalize the adiabatic approximation to the case of open quantum systems. What does this approximation look like? So that will be the subject I will discuss today. And as I said, there will be some applications. And the main result that I will show is that the adiabatic approximation generically breaks down in an open system after evolution that is long enough. So in contrast to the case of closed systems where adiabaticity, once you're in that regime, you can stay there forever. In an open system, typically that's not the case. Adiabaticity as an approximation will break down. You will start having energy level crossings, etc. Okay, so by way of motivation for why we started to think about this question, there was a paper some years ago by that was worked on in Ike Chuang's group at MIT, which was an experimental implementation of an adiabatic quantum optimization algorithm. Now, what exactly that is, a quantum optimization algorithm, I will not get into. The word adiabatic is the most important here. I'll just say that they used a nuclear magnetic resonance quantum computer, and their key result is an optimal runtime of the adiabatic algorithm. And here's the data. You don't have to understand anything about the actual experiment. There's only one thing to note here. Here's a measure of error. You can think of this as an error in the output of this algorithm. And the algorithm is supposed to perform better the more adiabatic the dynamics is. Now, intuitively, we'd expect that the slower we run the dynamics, the better an adiabatic algorithm is going to perform. Slow is adiabatic, right? But in contrast, the error as a function of the runtime, so the longer the runtime, the more adiabatic you'd expect things to be, the lower the error you'd expect to be. However, instead, there is a minimum here. Look at the X's. The X's are the experimental data. You see that there is an optimum at a runtime of 60 units. So rather than the error going down monotonously, it is actually increasing after a while. And the same thing can be seen here when you look at a particular element of the density matrix. So this result shows that in an open system, this is NMR, it's a real system, it's open with decoherence effects, something strange happens to the adiabatic approximation. It looks like indeed it breaks down after a while. That's what this minimum here indicates. Okay, so this is what got us to think about this problem. And let me say already at this point that in fact the intuitive explanation for what's going on is very simple. But the formal explanation is more involved, and that will be the main part of this talk. But intuitively what's going on is essentially this. Let's say that you have a system which is described by two energy levels, a ground state and excited state. So those are those two black lines here. Now, there's a gap between these energy levels. So as long as there's a gap, there's no crossing of energy levels, adiabatic approximation can persist. But now introduce the bath. The bath has many closely spaced energy levels. Those are the red energy levels here. And as you see, what happens is typically when you couple a system to a bath, there will be energy level broadening, and there will be an overlap. And as a consequence of this overlap, the adiabatic approximation is going to break down. So that's the essential effect that leads to the breakdown of adiabaticity. There's a competition between two timescales. One is your desire to evolve slowly, and the other one is the timescale set by the bath, which is a fast time scale. The competition between these two is what leads to an optimal time after which adiabaticity breaks down, and that's when there starts to be this overlap here. Okay, so now let me get into the more formal description of what's going on. Here's the typical setup for open quantum systems. We have a system, it's coupled to a bath, and there's a Hamiltonian that describes this interaction. And the end result of the analysis that hopefully everybody here is familiar with is that we can describe the dynamics of our system, which we now have to describe via density matrix, not through the Schrodinger equation, but rather in general through a so-called completely positive map. So this is actually not a differential equation. This is just a map from the initial time, rho at time zero, the state of time zero, to the final time. And the form of this map very generally can be written like so, where these operators, AI, are called Krauss operators, and they have to obey. This is a trace preservation condition of the density matrix. So there's, in general, for an open quantum system, there's this mapping between the initial and the final time, and let me call this map phi. And it's not the usual unitary dynamics that we get from the Schrodinger equation. Now, the setting in which I'm going to derive an adiabatic approximation is the setting where I assume that this map phi here is invertible. This is not universally applicable, but in many cases, this map is invertible. And if it is invertible, then we can write down a so-called convolutionless master equation, which can describe memory effects, even though it is local in time. So this is slightly counterintuitive. You see, this is a, I have a generator here which is local in time. It depends only on the instantaneous time t. Nevertheless, memory effects can be included in such a formalism under the assumption that the map phi is invertible. That's a formalism known as convolutionless master equations. And this generator here, L, can always be broken up into a Hamiltonian part and a dissipative part. And the most famous example is the Lindblad equation, which is local in time, which is Markovian. But as I said, our formalism is not restricted just to Markovian master equations. Any master equation that has this local in time structure, which comes from the fact that the map is invertible. So here's the Lindblad equation, except that I took the liberty of making the Lindblad operators time dependent. That means that I'm no longer in the Markovian regime. Well, that is an example of this kind of an equation. So this is the formal setting in which I will derive an adiabatic approximation. These so-called convolutionless master equations, which can describe non-Markovian effects. Okay, so now the issue is, in deriving an adiabatic approximation, if you remember, for closed systems, we have this notion of adiabaticity corresponds to being in a certain energy eigenspace and staying in that energy eigenspace. And there's no crossing, no transition between eigenspaces. Well, the notion of an eigenspace is associated with a generator that is diagonalizable, that has a complete orthonormal set of eigenvectors that form the basis for the space. But the problem is, in open systems, that these generators are typically not diagonalizable. In other words, they typically are not normal operators. They do not have associated with them a complete orthonormal set of eigenvectors. Okay, so this immediately leads to a conceptual problem. If I can't define a proper eigenspace, then what do I mean by staying in an eigenspace and evolving in it while the adiabatic dynamics takes place? So we have to find a formal tool that will replace the notion of a Hamiltonian eigenspace. So in order to do this, I need to digress for a couple minutes and remind you of the so-called Jordan form, Jordan canonical form. So it is a fact that any matrix, and I'll just use L for convenience, L is our generator, any matrix, whether it's diagonalizable or not, can be put into a so-called Jordan block diagonal form. And the Jordan block diagonal form comes about by performing a similarity transformation. S is an invertible matrix that is responsible for the similarity transformation. And you can always find an S such that after the similarity transformation, what we have is a block diagonal matrix. So these J's here are the blocks. And each block has this kind of structure. It has eigenvalues sitting along the diagonal, and then the new feature is that it has one sitting on this extra diagonal. No? The eigenvalues in general will be complex. Okay, so you can always calculate eigenvalues for any matrix. You just solve the characteristic equation. But you won't always get a complete orthonormal set of eigenvectors. That's a special property of normal matrices. Hermitian matrices are an example thereof. For arbitrary, for general matrices, you will get blocks that have this form. If you make this block one-dimensional, then you see there's just a single number here, and then you're back in the case where if all the blocks are one-dimensional, then the matrix is diagonalizable. So diagonalizable matrices are a special case where there is exactly one eigenvector per block, and there are no ones sitting here. But in the general case, what happens is that each one of these blocks has one right and one left eigenvector, and there's a deficiency. We don't have enough eigenvectors to span a complete basis. Okay, so yeah.
Is there any relationship between the operators that diagonalize it and these operators that we put in canonical form?
The Jordan canonical form is the same as the regular diagonal form for a matrix that's diagonalizable. Well, these blocks just shrink down to, and they become one-dimensional, okay? So you only get non-one-dimensional blocks, multi-dimensional blocks, if there is if the matrix is non-diagonalizable. However, any matrix can have, even if it's non-diagonalizable, it can have one-dimensional blocks. It's just that it will have at least one non-one-dimensional block, okay? So now the other thing to remember is that there are now right and left eigenvectors, and they're different. In the case of a normal matrix, the right and left eigenvectors, so right and left means you apply the matrix to the right or to the left. In the normal case, these coincide up to transpose and complex conjugation. In the non-normal case, they don't coincide. They're actually different, the right and left eigenvectors. But they do share the same eigenvalue. Okay, so once you've identified these blocks, you can reconstruct the block diagonal matrix. You just put all the blocks on the diagonal. Okay, so this formal tool is what is going to help us define adiabaticity in open systems, but I have to say a bit more about the formal stuff, and that is I have to explain the notion of a right and a left basis. So suppose that you find these right and left eigenvectors, as I said, one each per block. Now you apply the similarity transformation, this S, to the right and left eigenvectors, and then you can complete them to a basis just by doing Gram-Schmidt. You can complete these right and left transformed eigenvectors to a full basis for the space. So those vectors that are a basis for the space, I will use this somewhat elaborate notation. The double angle here means that we're not working in normal Hilbert space, we're working in Hilbert-Schmidt space, right, where you think of density matrices as vectors. So that's just to remind you that these are vectors, but actually originally they were matrices. Alpha is the index of a Jordan block, and I or J is the row index inside a given Jordan block. So now we have constructed a complete orthonormal basis for the space. Again, how do we arrive at it? We apply a similarity transformation to the right and left eigenvectors, and then we complete them to a basis by doing Gram-Schmidt. Okay, so what do these basis vectors behave like under the action of our superoperator, our generator? Well, if you apply the generator to a right eigenvector, you see it acts, over here it acts like just a normal, this is just a normal eigenvector with an eigenvalue, but there's also something that looks like a lowering operation. Right, it's as if you've lowered the index here, like just like a regular lowering operator. And similarly here, if you apply the generator to the left, you get a raising operator and the usual eigenvector component. Okay, and finally, the basis that we construct in this manner is orthonormal with respect to both the Jordan block index and with respect to the rows. So this is a proper orthonormal basis now. Yes? Trace. Yeah. Okay, so now that we have a proper basis for the space, we can use it to expand our density matrix. Okay, and we can expand the density matrix on the right basis, and from now on I'll do all my expansions on the right basis. Then this is the kind of expansion. It's a sum over all the blocks, that's beta, and it's a sum over all the rows within a given block. Each block has dimension n sub beta. And these are the amplitudes. You can think of these as the usual amplitudes in quantum mechanics, these r's here. These are the basis vectors. Okay, so that's the end of the formalism that we need. And now I can define adiabaticity in an open system. So first of all, let me just give, once again, a pretty rough definition, qualitative definition of adiabaticity in a closed system. So what's adiabaticity in a closed system? A closed quantum system undergoes adiabatic dynamics if its evolution is so slow that it proceeds independently in its instantaneous, decoupled Hamiltonian eigenspaces. That's the usual definition. Now, by analogy, here's how we define adiabaticity in an open system. The only thing that changes is that rather than talking about Hamiltonian eigenspaces, we talk about the superoperator or generator Jordan blocks. So Hamiltonian eigenspace is replaced by Jordan block of the generator. And each Jordan block is associated to distinct eigenvalue of L. Evolution takes place, adiabatic evolution takes place in a set of blocks, each of which is associated to a distinct eigenvalue of the generator. Okay, so that's the definition we propose. Simply replace Hamiltonian eigenspaces by superoperator Jordan blocks. And the first thing to do is to check that this definition has the right properties in the closed system limit, and indeed it does. So we can prove that this definition reduces to the usual definition and vice versa if we close the system and we just consider the superoperator as just the commutator of H with the density matrix. Okay, so here's yet another picture to try to make this notion more intuitive. Here is the version of adiabatic dynamics in closed systems. We take a Hamiltonian, we diagonalize it, so we get eigenspaces that I have indicated here by the eigenvalue, and the eigenvalue, the energy may be repeated, so we can have degenerate eigenspaces. And adiabatic dynamics is simply the statement that you, once you start in a given eigenspace with a given energy, you remain in that eigenspace throughout the dynamics. In an open system, replace those eigenspaces by Jordan blocks. So once you start in a given Jordan block, you stay in that Jordan block. That's the notion of adiabaticity in an open system. The spectrum is continuous as a function of time, you mean? Or?
No, I mean, because you can have
infinite. For an infinite system.
Yeah, but I mean an environment is basically infinite.
But this is a description, this L describes the system itself,
so
not the environment.
Okay. So this is only for the closed, for the non-distributive part.
No, this is the full superoperator, the full generator of the dynamics.
So what I'm trying to understand is that it seems a little
Yeah, so this entire formalism applies to open systems, and I'm talking only about the system, not about the bath, for which the Jordan spectrum is non-continuous. So it's finite dimensional, right. Yeah. So, okay, think of a finite dimensional system that's embedded in an arbitrary bath. That's the setting.
Right, so the full thing is continuous.
Right.
But somehow, by tracing and writing a reduced density matrix, you've lost that. And I'm having a hard time understanding where you lost that.
Okay, I think I'm going to have a hard time trying to answer that on the spot, so we'll talk about it later. But I think the point is well taken. So the assumption here is that these lambdas are not, they're discretely related, lambda 1 and lambda 2. They're not continuously transformable into one another. That is an assumption of this theory. Okay, so, all right, the first question that one would like to answer in this setting is, what is the condition on how much time can pass for dynamics to be adiabatic? So how slowly need we evolve in order to be in the adiabatic limit in an open system? So first let me just remind you what that condition is for closed systems. Okay, the time t, the total evolution time, has to be lower bounded by a certain ratio. And that ratio, which I've denoted by F over G squared, is basically the time derivative of the Hamiltonian divided by the minimum square of the spectral gap. Square, you take the calculated spectral gap, take the smallest one and square it, and that's this ratio is what the evolution time has to be larger than. If that condition is satisfied for all gaps, well, okay, we're taking the minimum. If this condition is satisfied, then we are in the adiabatic limit. This is the classic result that you get if you open up Messiah or Schiff or any of the textbooks. You will find this derived. Okay, so how is this generalized? Now that we have our definition of dynamics, of the adiabatic dynamics in an open system, how is this generalized in the open system case? Okay, so what happens is that the condition roughly stated is the following. Instead of the Hamiltonian generator of the dynamics, we need the superoperator generator of the dynamics, which I denoted L. And instead of a square of the spectral gap, we'll get a sum, as you'll see on the next slide, powers of the spectral gap. Now, the spectral gap here doesn't refer to energies. Rather, it refers to the difference between the generally complex value Jordan eigenvalues. Okay, so energies are replaced by these eigenvalues that are complex valued in general. You have to take the absolute value thereof and raise it to some power. And the total evolution time has to be greater than this ratio then. That's essentially what's going on. Now, the derivation is rather complicated, and so is the final result. And I'm not going to try to explain this ugly formula to you, except to point out a few features and then to simplify it progressively. Even though this looks horrendous, there's a simple structure here. There is a numerator and there is a denominator. The numerator, which always involves this quantity V, well, V is just the time derivative of the generator, just like we had the time derivative of the Hamiltonian. And the denominator involves a spectral gap, this little omega here, is just the gap between the Jordan eigenvalues. And you see it's raised to various powers. And the details I cannot explain right now. But here's a simplified version of this equation. This one was for the most general case when you have a multidimensional Jordan block. This is if we have just a one-dimensional Jordan block. So then a lot of sums disappear. And again, you see the simple structure where you have in the numerator the time derivative of the generator and the denominator, and now we just have the square of the spectral gap. So this is for one-dimensional block. But there is a new quantity that appears in these formulas, which was not there in the case of closed systems, and that is this e to the total time t omega, capital omega. Capital omega is the time integral of the spectral gap. And if I rewrite this in the simplest possible form, what all these formulas are saying is just the following very simple statement. The total time t, condition for adiabatic dynamics, your total time, evolution time t, has to be much greater than, for each Jordan block alpha, some quantity which is a fixed number a, plus b times e to the ct. Now, if you stare at this formula for more than a second, you realize that if c is positive, this formula will never be satisfiable for arbitrarily large t's, capital T's, right? You can't have t being bigger than e to the positive number times t. This formula will be violated for some finite time capital T. And this is the formal statement that adiabaticity must break down in an open system. The condition for adiabaticity, which is this, cannot be satisfied provided this quantity c, which is related to okay, the integral of the spectral gap, provided this quantity is positive, and this typically is going to be the case. So this formula contains the statement that adiabaticity is going to break down in an open system. Okay, and because you can try to optimize this inequality, well, that is what leads to the optimal time of evolution for adiabatic dynamics, what you saw in the NMR experiment that I presented in the beginning. Now, why does this not happen in a closed system? What's the difference? In a closed system, this quantity here, this that involves in an open system potentially a positive function omega, in a closed system, this function omega is also there, but it's purely imaginary. It's just I times the difference of energies of the Hamiltonian. But in an open system, this quantity can be real. Now, if it's imaginary, as it is in a closed system, then this is a very fast oscillating integral. You see, you have the total time t here, which we can make arbitrarily large. And when you have a very fast oscillatory integrand, then, as you know, this makes the integral go away. Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Sorry? It is, in an open system, it is complex. It has an oscillatory part, but it also has a real part. And that part will dominate. Yeah, but the real part will dominate it. I mean, this phenomenon of a fast oscillatory integral, canceling the integral, that is only true if you don't have a real part in the exponential. Okay, so that's the difference. Okay. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, so as I said, you need this to be positive. Positive real. Okay? That's when you get the violation of this condition for some finite time capital T. What exactly is C alpha? You can extract from these expressions, but and the formula is complicated, but it is directly related to this quantity capital omega, which is again the time integral of the spectral gap. Yes, that's right. The minimum spectral gap in a given Jordan block. Between Jordan blocks, excuse me. Here are the exact definitions. Okay. Yes. This formula is the general formula for when you have a multidimensional Jordan block. It reduces to this if that Jordan block is one-dimensional. As I was saying before, a matrix is diagonalizable if and only if all its Jordan blocks are one-dimensional. Okay? So you can have a matrix that has all its Jordan blocks except one-dimensional. As soon as it has one two-dimensional block, then it's not diagonalizable. Okay. Okay. So, all right. Now I'd like to move on to applications. How much time do I have, Paul? Where is Paul? Okay. I assume I have infinite time, if that's the case. I've been going adiabatically. I hope that this basic message, which comes out of this complicated formalism, is clear. There is a breakdown time which one can calculate from this formula. I haven't told you a thing about what C alpha is in real systems, so I haven't given you any intuition about what these numbers are, whether typically they should be positive or not. And the statement is that, yes, they should typically be positive. And in order to convince you that this is the case, I'm going to discuss an example in the context of geometric phases. So first of all, what is a geometric phase? Well, there are two types. There's the so-called Berry or abelian phase, and there is the non-abelian phase. let me start with the simple case of the abelian, the Berry phase. And this is what it is in a closed system. The Berry phase is a purely geometric phase that's acquired by quantum state undergoing cyclic adiabatic evolution. So let's say that we have some control parameters, for example, a magnetic field, that we vary in some cyclical manner. So the control field is denoted R here, and we vary it in a cyclical manner over some loop C in some parameter space. Okay, so when we do that, the Hamiltonian, which depends on these parameters, starts out at zero and then returns to the same value at capital T. And this is the adiabatic Schrödinger equation, again. And now you can solve, as Berry did in his famous paper from more than 20 years ago, you can solve the Schrödinger equation in this adiabatic limit. And what you find is that the state at time, the final time t, has the usual dynamic phase, but it also has a geometric phase, which I denoted by gamma n here for the nth eigenstate. And this is the formula for this geometric phase. and thousands upon thousands of papers have been written on this subject. Okay, so now the natural question is, can we generalize this? This is adiabatic dynamics, after all. Can we generalize this concept of a geometric phase to the open system setting now that we have a formalism? And the answer is yes, and this is what I would like to take you through in a couple of minutes. The calculation is simple enough that I think it's even followable on one slide. So we start from our convolutionalist master equation. Now the generator depends on this vector field implicitly on time through this vector field. We do the expansion in the right eigenbasis, in the right basis, excuse me, as I said before, and we factor out the dynamical phase. And here the dynamical phase is associated with the Jordan eigenvalues. And then we're left with these amplitudes here, and the task is to calculate these amplitudes. Okay, so we just plug this expansion into our master equation, and we get a set of coupled differential equations for these amplitudes, P. Now, if I consider the case of one-dimensional Jordan blocks, let's say that all Jordan blocks are one-dimensional now. So it is a diagonalizable matrix, but it can have complex eigenvalues in general for an open system. Then all these equations decouple, and you just have one equation per Jordan block for these amplitudes. You can immediately solve this. This is the formal solution, right? And gamma is given by this integral over this quantity here. And you can rewrite this a little bit, remembering that T only appears through our vector field, and you get the generalized Berry phase, which is just rewriting this expression here for the phase. This is the expression for the generalized Berry phase. Compare it to the expression for closed systems. You see that they're very, very similar. The difference is that whereas in the closed system we have the eigenvector, the left and right eigenvectors are the same thing, but here we actually have the true left eigenvector, the true right eigenvector, and they're not the same thing. So compare these two expressions, and that's the Berry phase, the abelian geometric phase for an open system. Now, am I justified in calling it a geometric phase, this quantity? Not everything is geometric, just because it looks like the closed system Berry phase. So, yes, indeed, it is. It has all the right properties. In fact, from the very definition, you can see that it depends only on the path that is traversed in parameter space, so that's why we can call it geometric. Moreover, it's gauge invariant. It's another property of the usual Berry phase. It's gauge invariant in the sense that you cannot modify this expression by multiplying the eigenvectors by some complex quantity here. So it's invariant under these transformations of our eigenvectors, of our basis vectors. It has the right limit. It reduces, this expression reduces to the Berry phase in the limit of closing the system. Actually, what it reduces to is not quite, I'm lying a little bit, it doesn't reduce to the actual Berry phase, it reduces to a difference of Berry phases. And that is very intuitive because what we're dealing with is the evolution of the density matrix. So in the density matrix setting, everything is energy differences, even in the closed system limit. And anyway, all we can measure in an experiment is not absolute phases, but but phase differences. That's interferometry. So it's natural that the measurable quantity that we obtain is actually a difference of geometric phases. That's what you would typically measure anyway. And finally, what's the new feature here? The new feature is that this phase can be complex. The Berry phase, the usual Berry phase, is real. But here we can have an imaginary part, and that means that there is a visibility associated with this phase. And that visibility, again, is a natural aspect of dynamics of open systems. Okay, now, given how much time I have left, I'm going to skip this non-abelian geometric phase. We can also do the same exercise and get the so-called non-abelian geometric phase, the Wilczek-Z gauge potential, or the holonomic connection. We can reproduce, or essentially generalize the results from open system, from closed systems to this case of degenerate Jordan blocks. And I want to very quickly present an example. which will illustrate this in more physical terms. So consider Berry's original example, which is the case of a spin one-half in a magnetic field. Okay, so here's the Hamiltonian. B is the magnetic field. S is our spin. And the magnetic field is time-dependent in some adiabatic manner. Now, we're going to add to this, we're going to open the system. So we're going to add a dephasing channel and a spontaneous emission channel. Okay, so here sigma z is the dephasing operator, and sigma minus is the spontaneous emission operator. And I'm going to do this now in the Markovian limit. So in the Markovian limit, what it means is that you have to diagonalize the Hamiltonian and apply the similarity transformation, the unitary transformation, and the diagonal of the Hamiltonian, you have to apply it to the dephasing operator and the spontaneous emission operator. So these operators here, gamma z, gamma minus, they are the Lindblad operators now that appear in this Markovian limit of the Berry spin one-half magnetic field example. And now we're going to calculate the geometric phase in this setting. Okay, so what you can show is that the superoperator, which is the sum of the Hamiltonian part and the dissipative part, is special. In fact, it is diagonalizable in this case. And you can diagonalize it because, in fact, H and R, the Hamiltonian, the dissipative part, commute. So you can diagonalize L in the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. But the Hamiltonian, obviously, doesn't depend on these decoherence parameters, beta z, beta minus, measure how strong the decoherence is, how strong the dephasing is, how strong spontaneous emission is. H doesn't depend on these parameters. Therefore, through this chain here, L, the superoperator, doesn't depend on these parameters. And that means that in this Markovian limit of having dephasing and spontaneous emission, in fact, the geometric phase is immune to dephasing and spontaneous emission. So, in fact, the geometric phase in this case is the same as it is in the corresponding closed system case. But the adiabaticity time does depend on these parameters. So even though the geometric phase is quantitatively the same as it is in the closed system, adiabaticity itself breaks down after some finite time. And that means that, well, the adiabatic geometric phase, of course, disappears. And then the adiabatic approximation is longer defined. So how does that happen? And this will probably be where I stop, Paul. look at the total time on the x-axis, and on the y-axis I put the ratio of the breakdown time divided by the total time. Okay, so the condition that has to be satisfied is total time has to be much greater than this thing, which, as you may recall, was this horrendous expression. Okay, so that horrendous expression is what is actually calculated in order to make this plot. We want this quantity to be much less than 1. If it is much less than 1, then our total time is large enough such that adiabaticity holds. Okay, so here's the spin one-half magnetic field example. Initially, the time is just short. The total time is short, so we're not in the adiabatic limit. This quantity is large. That means we're not in the adiabatic limit, because the total time is just too short. But then, as we increase the time, we are in the adiabatic limit. But then comes the surprise, the open system surprise. As we keep increasing the time, we come out of the adiabatic limit. We can no longer satisfy this condition that capital T much greater than this. You see these curves start to rise again. So this rise indicates the breakdown of adiabaticity in this case. Even though the geometric phase is the same quantitatively as it is for the closed system, adiabaticity itself breaks down. And the last thing I'll point out about this is that the three different curves here correspond to three different values of the magnetic field. So what do you think is going to happen if you increase the magnetic field? Well, increasing the magnetic field increases the spacing between the energy eigenvalues of the spin one-half, and the more apart they are, the less overlap you'll have from the broadening due to the bow. So you'd expect that as you increase the magnetic field, the adiabatic approximation is going to survive longer, and that's indeed the case. You see the blue curve is large magnetic field, the purple curve is small magnetic field. You stay low the larger is the magnetic field. And the very final thing I want to say is what happens if you have bit flips. I talked about dephasing and spontaneous emission. I don't want to give you the wrong impression that the geometric phase is totally immune to everything. It's not immune to bit flip processes. So this is sigma x. And here is the geometric phase, which we can calculate from our formula from before, in units of pi, as a function of the decoherence strength. So when n is x, that's that's where, in this case, the bit flip case. And then you see that the geometric phase itself deviates from its closed system value. The baseline here, the straight line here, is the closed system value. So you see the geometric phase itself deviates from that closed system value. It acquires a different value. Its real component acquires a different value from the closed system value. And that indicates the open system effect on the geometric phase itself, subject to this bit flip channel. Okay, so I have more, but I know I'm over time, so I'll stop here, and maybe I'll just skip all the way to the very end where you can look at the conclusions and see where this work was published. Thanks for your attention.